This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
Hello everyone, this is Clint Locklear from Trapping Across America. I'm in my 1,500 square foot lure shed, and the reason I want to tell you that is you're probably going to hear some noise in the background, and I wish I could tell you that I'm in some tropical jungle somewhere trapping jaguar, but all the bird noises you're probably going to hear are some future crispy fried duck that's running around in truck boxes in one of the rooms. So if you hear a bunch of chirping and stuff in the background, I'm as far away from them as I can, but that's what they are. And that brought up a funny thing the other day. Travis, my right-hand man, came in, and he goes, comes through the door, and I've got one of those great big aluminum truck boxes with some ducks in there that I'm raising for eggs and different things. And he looks at them and he goes, "Ducks in the lure shop in a truck box. That's so redneck." And I have to admit, that cracked me up, guys, because it, I guess in a way that it is. And I did learn a lesson. If you ever tries to raise ducks, when we brought them in, I thought it'd be easier to take care of them. So in one of our back spare bedrooms in the house, I put them there so I keep an eye on them, because I've never brooded ducks before. And but let me give you a fair warning, even for a trapper and a trapper's wife. When you put ducks that are very messy in a great big tub and put a heat lamp on them so they don't get cold, and you got that heat cooking down on all the birds and the crap and the spilt water and everything, that is something that takes about 4 days to get out of your house. So if you ever decide to do the ducks, guys, no matter how much you like stinky stuff coming out of bottles, your wife will not appreciate that odor, because it is very different and the heat makes it very strong. But we have a very interesting show tonight. We're going to talk about jaw guards, if I get to everything. Some stuff on DP traps when you're trying to set those up around rip wraps, which is around a lot of bridges. 80-20 rule when it comes to your trapping. And then taking care of your body. And if I get to it, grinding meat for bait, because I'm starting to get a lot of questions. It's that time of year where guys are going about and they're wanting to make their own bait, play with that, and I think that's cool, knock yourself out. But there's always, once you get into it, you find out it may not be quite as simple as you thought of. So, and I've got one question from that. Well, let me go and address that one, because it won't take very long. So a lot of the questions I'm getting, people have beaver meat, bobcat meat, deer meat, groundhog meat, all kind of stuff. One guy called about, he had ducks, as a matter of fact. I guess he was a duck hunter or whatever. And using that for personal use, I think you're fine. If you're going to try to get into commercial use and you start grinding up ducks, you better really check the laws, because that's a federally protected game bird. And I don't know what it is, because I've never used duck for that simple reason, or geese, even though it probably would be a good oily a bait per se. You're probably going to run into laws if someone ever questions what it is and decides to get a case of the red butt against you and call the federal boys. So be careful about that. But most of the questions have been on tanning. And when it comes to this meat, guys, there's four ways to handle this meat if you're going to do it. A grinder, to me, is the best way. Most commercial bait today is ground, and it's actually double ground, so it's somewhat pasty. It's not chunky and it doesn't look like hamburger meat. But if it looks like hamburger meat for your own self, that's really okay. It doesn't matter. But you got ground or double ground. You've got chunked. And then you've got fresh, tainted, or heavy tainted. And then you got buried. Buried's a very old school way. It does give it a unique flavor. I really don't think it's any better, and I don't know of any commercial guy that really sells any amount of volume that can do that and keep up with a lot of orders. But it does give it a very unique smell. Basically, you just bury the stuff in the ground. It stays pretty much a constant temperature, and it does get a different odor to it. No question about that one. So that's one way to go about it. The other ways are, you want to use it where it's fresh, which are some applications are really, really good. Slightly tainted and heavily tainted. And a lot of this is just like, you know, personal preference more than anything. You know, some meats do better tainted than fresh. If you're going to get in the bait making business, you need to figure that out, and that's through testing. All I'm doing is giving you a compass here. I'm not giving you exacts, because I'd take all the fun away from it and you wouldn't figure out what you would learn on your own. But you need to pick. Do I want it fresh? Do I want it slightly tainted or heavy tainted? Fresh is just what it means. You grind it up or chunk it up. You preserve it then. If you're going to add something or not, that's when you do it. Now, this is where the questions come. And I guess it's kind of odd to me, because I do so much meat for Bates. I just never thought that it'd really be a question, but what the questions are is they all kind of form around this one little bitty question. Do I taint the meat, then grind it, or grind the meat, then taint it? And I guess from a smell point of view, guys, it wouldn't matter which one of those you did. You could do it in either order. But I will tell you, grinding fresh meat is a lot more pleasant than grinding tainted meat. So the way that I do it personally is the meat is ground, then it's tainted, then it's preserved, and then it may or may not get additives put to it depending on what I'm using that base for. But if you're going to decide to make your own bait and you're going to let it taint, it's easy at the time being to let it taint in the bucket. Then you're going to have to deal with that stuff with all the juices and extra juices that you're going to get off of that and run that through a grinder, and it's going to be popping all over the place and it's going to be all over you and you're going to smell like butt for days because you can't hardly wash that stuff off. So my advice to you guys that want to play with your own bait, grind it, then make a decision on what you want to do with it. And you should really already know that ahead of time because sometimes it's good to have fresh and tainted or slightly tainted. And slightly tainted is exactly what it means. It just starts getting a little bit of odor that's way beyond the fresh, and then you preserve it. And tainted is, most of the time, people let the top of it almost get like a greenish-looking color till it's about an inch deep in a five-gallon bucket. And then they preserve it then, and that. But when you take that green off, it's really still hot pink or hot red or whatever the color of the meat is. Because the taint hadn't went all the way through, just the top part of that. When you mix that together, it is strong. I can't imagine a reason why you would want to have tainted all the way through the bottom, because that's what you would call rotten. And if you wanted a killer possum or a skunk bait, that may not be a bad thing. But for coyotes and stuff like that, I would stay away from the rotten stuff. And I know there's some rotten stuff on the market that the guys are selling and saying it's bait, and it's you're just not going to have the results of that. And the reason I can say that is when you go out and test it, you'll see rotten does not do as good as fresh, tainted, or heavily tainted meat. And it depends on the type of meat. And then it also depends on what you're going to do to it after, as far as what you're going to put in there with it, on which one of those you want. But that's going to be totally up to you. And the only way to go down that journey, guys, is to go down that journey. I'm not going to tell you exactly what I've done in each one of my baits. That's crazy. The only thing that I probably am planning on doing for next year is we're selling so much Federales. I mean, insane amounts of Federales in the wintertime. That just to try to take some of the pressure off of me and Travis is we're probably going to sell a Federales bait solution. That way you can get more volume of that because it's working so good for all y'all, and then you can use your own meat. And I'll tell you on that one that you need to have slightly tainted, not fresh and not super tainted, but you'll have just slightly tainted meat. You'll add that in and then you'll go about it. But I'm not going to tell you what's in the formula, and yours won't smell exactly like mine because you're not going to have the three kind of meats that are tainted exactly the way mine are. But that bait solution is really going to rock and roll for you if you use it. Okay, let's get to jaw guards. This is one of those subjects, especially at demos. If you sit around and watch demos or DVDs, people have some very hard and set and fast rules when it comes to guards. And I'm going to talk more about coyotes than anything else here, because if you can get away with it on coyotes, you can get away with it on anything. And once you get away from coyotes and you start going down the scale, You can guard a bobcat a whole lot different, which I've talked about in the past, and I've got all kind of videos on YouTube showing how I do the vertical blocking, build the shoot, and all that type stuff. Fox are a little more like coyotes. Coon you can get really crazy with. You know, then the other animals, it doesn't really matter. Otter needs to be, you know, really natural if you're setting dry land stuff. Beaver, not as much. You can guide them in a lot more, but we're going to concentrate on coyotes because that's normally where the questions come in. And there's so much like I said, there's like self-imposed rules or beliefs involved with this that I'm not sure as productive as people think they are. And again, guys, this is all my opinion. If you believe one of these and you want to do it your way, knock yourself out. You're not hurting me in one bit, and I'm not attacking you in any form or any way whatsoever. When I talk about any subject, all I can do is talk about the experiences that I've had, especially looking at all the night vision footage, looking at the tracks and different things like that, and coming up with, over a long period of time, with a lot of animals and a lot of sets, especially on the misses, what happened. And when I first started coyote trapping, like everybody else, you kind of did the two things that you see most people doing. And one, you put a little low spot over the pan because that's going to guide his foot. And then you're going to have a pebble somewhere around that trap to guide him over towards the trap. And in theory, that sounds really good. I know it does. It looks good at a demo. It looks good, like, you know, you're being all ninja up on the coyote when you do something like that. But it doesn't really matter. If you follow coyote tracks down a mud road, you will see that they have no variance at all between low ground and high ground. Makes no difference to that. So having a quarter inch or a half inch drop over a pan, guys, isn't going to mean absolutely nothing to a coyote. Now, if you're doing something like a Charlie Robbins dirt hole set or a trench set or something like Matt Jones has done, and you've got a step down set, that is a totally different thing. But an open pattern with a little bitty indention over the trap pan may make you feel better. But it's not going to make one hill of beans to a coyote, because if you follow their tracks, they don't hopscotch around to stay on the high side. And when you see one of them work a trap, especially in night vision, they don't care. They're not, they're like, most of the time they're coming in at a high rate of speed for several times before they get the nerve up to work the set anyway. And they're coming in like a bulldozer. I mean, I've had them tear blocking off logs that are 6-8 inches round that I put up behind the set. That I've seen them pull them back. So thinking that that stopped him from sitting there, from stepping there, is crazy, because he pulled it out of the way. I've seen them step on little rocks. I've seen them step on sticks that are laying on top of the ground. I've seen them go up to high spots so they can be able to look in. It's kind of crazy when you really think about what a coyote does at a set. So thinking that the technique of having a little low spot over a trap, which is going to hold water, and if you've got any rain in your area, it's going to be an issue, but take that completely out of the situation. Having that little bitty half inch drop over your, it's not going to make any difference to a coyote. I really don't think it makes any difference to a fox or coon or anything else. Because in their world, you see, our world, we think in stuff being level and square and dress right dress and this, that, and the other. In nature, it's not that way. The only flat places on America, and they're not truly flat, are salt pans. And they still have a little bit of grade to them going towards the middle, but they seem flat over a big area. No matter if you live in Iowa or anywhere where they grade the ground, it's still not flat. If you run a string over 100 yards or 10 feet in any direction, you'll see that it's not flat. And that coyote works through that area, and he's not hopscotching between low spot to low spot because it makes him feel more comfortable. And to try to put a flat set with a flat open pattern with a little bitty low spot that's going to guide his foot, like I said, it sounds good, it looks good, it makes somebody feel all ninja about what they're doing, but I don't think it's really going to matter. The same with a little pebble. That's not, you know, I don't care if it's 2 or 3 inches around. If a coyote's working a set, or if he's chasing something in the woods, or he's digging out a rabbit or a groundhog, his feet's going everywhere. He's not cautiously doing anything. When he decides to work that set and actually work the set, it's at a very rapid pace because his head's down. Most of the time, there's going to be some unusual odors there. It's not going to look just like an animal did it, so he's going to be a little bit high-strung, and he's going to work it just like if you were trying to do something really fast and you're in a panic about it type thing. So having the little bitty rock, I've seen them step all over them. I've seen them step on sticks where I've tried to use guides or kind of like to push them over to one side of a set, and I'll have a stick that's probably, you know, half inch, three quarter inch to an inch in diameter, kind of lay that in, they'll step on that. Because in their normal world, outside of the trap set that's only a couple square feet, they do it every day. And if you don't think so, if you follow a coyote down a trail through the woods, you'll see that just as often as they step over a root, they'll step on the root. If you follow the tracks and keep in mind they got 4 feet, you'll see that they step on it as much as they step over it. So there's no difference between that and your set and what they do on a day-to-day basis. Now, if you want to use guards on your set, I think they're very handy and I think they're very useful. Because it does give you some extra percentages when you're coming up, when he's coming up to the set and he's going to work the set. You want him to get over your trap. I get that. You know, every trapper tries to find an advantage. Well, one thing you'll notice in nature, if you go walking around, very few things, except for stock animals, step on crap. They just don't do it. So if you've got a dropping and you're sitting there and you set that, if you're trying to push him to the left or right and you put a big pile of droppings, you want to try to push him to the right, you can put those to the left. It'll help guide him a little bit because he's not going to want to step on those droppings. To me, the guard does better, especially if you're using natural pathways to a set, the way we've talked about it, you know, 5, 6, 8 shows ago, or you put a trap for a coyote. You're better off with the guide to either be on the back or the front, facing the approach of the coyote to the set. So you want him to step over the dropping, or you want him to stop in front of the dropping, because he's not going to step on the dropping. And at least then you've got a higher percentage of them doing what you want to do, but it's still not going to be 100%. There's nothing 100% in coyote. And if anybody ever tells you that they know where a coyote's going to step out of set, they're either delusional, overly egotistical, or they're just pulling your leg. It's one of the three, because coyotes are individuals. They do their own thing. They all have different personalities between a pup and a big, raunchy alpha male. And they're going to do their own thing. So all a jaw guard's going to do at a coyote set is just maybe give you some extra percentages. That's really what it's going to be. So the other thing on jaw guards, of all the ones I've tried, between rocks and sticks and different things like that, grass clumps seem to do okay, because you can kind of like, you know, open the ground up and plant it. And if it's got a root mass on the bottom, like buffalo grass or something, they're not going to want as much to step in it if they've got clear ground around it, because they're going to be really paying attention to the set. But just having vertical sets. Now, Craig O'Gorman does this by having 3 sticks pushed vertical in the ground. That means up and down. One's in front at an angle facing towards the hole. They're on the sides facing out from the trap. So you've got almost like on 45 degree angle. So it opens it up more, but it's vertical, and the coyote has a tendency to step more inside of that than not. It does better that way if you have your trap set left or right dog going into however you're setting your setup. If you got your dog on the right, for instance, that stick should be more vertical to keep them off that dead space of the trap. But if your dog is towards the front or towards the back, then this little horseshoe he's kind of making with the sticks are pointed out at a 45 degree angle away from the pan of the trap. And if you do that, you'll see it's a lot more open than if you stick those sticks straight up in the air. So if you're wanting to push a coyote maybe to, say, the right, for some reason you think that it's too open and he may come around, or the wind's goofing with you, or whatever it is, or you're seeing weird things on your set. You know, if you go take a small, I'm talking small piece of brush, kind of trim off the tops, run those around in the dirt so you don't have the really white stuff showing there, and kind of stick that to the left of your trap, or to the left in front of your trap, or however you think the best way is, and you've got all those little pointy sticky things sticking up. that's going to keep a coyote from going into that particular area, and he's going to take the easier route. I think the problem with the little indentions over the pans and the little rocks and the little sticks laying on top of the ground is people think that that's going to move a coyote one way or the other. But when you have something that's going to make it uncomfortable, and something sticking up out of the ground is uncomfortable to step on just for him like it is for you, he's going to avoid it. That's the big difference. In Texas, you can take a cactus. If you've got the little bitty cactuses that grow on the ground, not the great big ones, but the little bitty natural cactuses, you can dig that up and plant it right next back to where you want it. That coyote ain't going to step on it. He knows, he's learned from a little one, that he's not going to do that. But most trappers that hear this aren't in cactus country. So that's not really going to work, you know. So you're going to have to think about, you know, pine cones are not comfortable to step on. If you have gum balls out of the trees, like from the sugar gum, those aren't very nice to step on either for you or them. If you're around somewhere that has chestnuts, like I grow chestnuts, if you've ever seen the husk on a chestnut, it looks like a miniature sea urchin or a miniature porcupine. And those are very sharp. And a lot of times, I'll take the nuts out and I'll keep those husk. And they're round. They're about the size between a golf ball. They're bigger than a golf ball, but smaller than a tennis ball. They're about that round. And if you know someone that's got chestnut trees, trust me, they will be so glad for you to go get them out of the yard, because 6 months later, if you try to walk across that grass with flip-flops on, you're going to stab yourself in the foot. And that's a very natural thing, even if a coyote didn't see it, because it smells just like a tree. And you can, you know, dig a little indention real quick and kind of plant that where you want it. And a coyote is not going to step on a chestnut hole. So either use a dropping, use something that's vertical, but always make sure what you're using is vertical, is uncomfortable to the coyote. And that way you at least have a shot, guys, at getting that coyote where you want him to go and give you those extra little percentages. Because if you try to force a coyote too much to one way, they seem to have this sixth sense of survival, and they'll go the complete opposite way. And I've seen them on film come down through blackberry bushes, have to low crawl off a hill. They've done all kind of things if I try to force them too much. But having a couple of pine cones or vertical sticks or chestnut holes or something like that, there ain't nothing unnatural about that. For one, you don't want these things sticking up 6, 8, 10 inches. You just want them 3, 4 inches out of the ground. And anything that's dug in nature, if they hit a root or they go around a piece of shrub or something, it sticks up like that anyway. So it's not like you're doing something totally unnatural. If you step back from a coyote set and it looks man-made, then you need to go back to work on that set, because it's going to hurt you if it looks like a trapper did it. Okay, the next thing I want to go into on tonight's show is riprap. That's becoming more and more popular, even around places where it hadn't been, and it drives me crazy. And what I see more going in Tennessee, which I haven't seen before, is when they do repair work on these culverts, they're on the edge where it's easy to get to, they're dumping all this riprap, this big jungled up rock. So pockets are out, everything's out, and instead of having a normal culvert almost like a bridge the way they used to do it, the way that's in all the trapping books anyway, they're pouring concrete in the bottom of these things. And it's flat concrete, it's level. And it goes all the way under the road and it comes out in front of the culvert, normally about a foot and a half to 2 feet. And then where the wing walls are on the culvert, they're coming in with concrete about a foot and a half, which is great for mink if your water levels are right. It's great for coon if your water levels are right, because you can just blind set on top of that. Most time, that's if you're using a foothold trap, that's as simple as just cutting a piece of sod, you know, on your way down, flipping it upside down so you can set the trap in the muddy part. and you can stabilize the trap on there. Or if you use long springs, you can just go straight to the concrete. It's one of the reasons I like long springs. I don't have to goof around with sod because it kind of self-beds itself. But what if you're a dog-proof trapper? This last year, playing around more and more, and as they keep upgrading, if you want to call it that, but it's a downgrade for trappers the way they're doing the culverts, it becomes a lot more interesting because if you go outside the riprap, you're in the sight of everybody because any car that drives down the road is going to be able to see your coon there. If it's not deep enough to drown the coon, you've got a live coon ringing out right on the side of the road. And if it's a halfway decent road, there's, you know, 15,000 people over a 24-hour period just looking at your coon. One of them's going to mess with you. If you try to set a DP up in that concrete that's solid on the bottom, how in the world do you stabilize it? And the more that I see this, the more that I've ran into this, even when I'm in Alabama, I'm starting to see it when I'm in a lot of different places, is one of the reasons that I'm so fond of the Freedom Brand dog-proof traps. Because the Freedom Brand has got a flat staking system on the bottom. And there's two ways to use that. I'm more interested in speed and efficiency, and I've got other things to do, so I'm not going to goof around a lot. And they've got, on my drags, they've got a bracket, and they've actually making Sabertooth Juniors now with this bracket already on there. So I can go under there. I can normally find something, either big rocks or crevices or a piece of re-rod or a root that's down in the deep hole or whatever. And I can run that chain around that, and then I can set the drag up where I want the trap. In that bracket, I can just pull the chain up, slide that down in that little notch, and my dog proof is totally secure on riprap or a solid concrete floor. Now, back when I was filming, doing a lot of, I was going up to Scott's and was doing some coon videoing. He had some farmers that wanted us, they're having coon get, that lived in their barn and were tearing stuff up in their barn and putting droppings on hay bales and eating feed and all kind of stuff. We went inside some of those barns, it was solid concrete. And we would sit there and have to goof around with zip ties and wire and try to push stuff up against the trap to have it secure enough that the animal wasn't just flipping out when he looked at it. And it took a lot of time. Well, these drags, or even if you took, I think F&T sells a plate. I've seen it at conventions. I've got one that it's just a, I don't know, 6-7 inch plate, 6-7 inches. It's a quarter inch metal, I guess. It's somewhat heavy, but you could just, you could literally drill a hole in that thing and treat it like a drag. So if you drilled a hole in the corner of that thing, you could cable off to it. So when you came to these situations, you could just plop the flat metal piece down on the concrete or wedge that thing up under some riprap. Or what I've done before, if you can kind of have a mental image with me, if you can see a coon trail that's too exposed and it's going over riprap and it's solid riprap, you can kind of look at the rocks and the mud prints and see where that coon's going. And you want to have your dog proofs really, 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 really close to the trail. On the trail is even better. And then you can go out of sight of the traffic, and with that metal brace, with that riprap, a lot of times I can put two or three real heavy rocks on the corners, and I can set that in, on the riprap sitting up in the coon's trail, with enough weight on that that most time the coon can't take it anywhere because they're dealing with those big riprap rocks. So you've got it pinned in there with the flat surface of the plate that comes with that thing. And that worked out very well. And I've got a lot of metal that I've just welded those brackets onto. And, you know, and I just pick up strange stuff all the time. So there's no telling what it could be. You could weld those to fence posts. You could weld them to just, I don't know if you can weld the tie plates, but if you can, you could weld it on a small tie plate, junk metal, anything like that. And if you're on your home ground, you can ride around in the summer and go, well, you know, those things would make these 13 locations, or these 26, or these 50 locations over, it would be so much easier if I could just drop this thing down and hook the trap into it and not have to sit there and screw around forever. And that's a huge advantage, guys, to because one of the beauty of a dog-proof trap is the speed in which you can put it in. But the way that most of them are designed, except for the Freedom brand, the way they have that, unless you're going to carry around a drill or something, is if it's not just really pushable dirt, you're going to have to start zip tying and wiring and playing construction worker to get those things in. And that really eats your time up over a day. So even though it seems, well, I don't want to have that extra weight, you can put that stuff out ahead of time and just, you know, have a way to secure your cable to the piece of metal with the bracket on there and go about it. Another really cool thing with the way that the Freedom brand brackets are is everybody knows Coons cross creeks at certain places over fallen logs. Well, those brackets have these little holes on them. And I can just take some cheap wood screws before season out in the middle of that thing and put three or four dog proofs down the middle of those logs that have been wearing out for generations. And then I can cable off to that tree or cable the two ends off to the bank. However I can do it, try to get as many of these coons together so I can get one out of the way of the next one so I can make double catches instead of securing him right there on the log where he's going to be aggressive to anything that comes around him. I can set those things up ahead of season and until a flood or something crazy happens or someone buys the property and clears the banks or something, some of those brackets that I've put in now are probably going to be there 10 years from now. And the coon trails on some of these logs, especially one of my favorite ones on our river systems here, we have high banks because we get a lot of flooding. And you'll see these coon trails coming down the bank. And those coon trails will move a little bit depending on whatever the coon are thinking. So they may be up or down or whatever. But if you've got a gully or you have erosion coming off the bank and there's a log or a tree fell across it or there's a pipe where the coon can get on it and go about it without having going all the way to the water or all the way to the top or having to mountain climb up and down the gully, you can put these brackets on there. Even metal you can drill into if you did it ahead of time. But if you see these gullies and you kind of get a gist of where the coon trails are at, you could take a log, you could get some cheap rebar or some type of stake, and you can drive it on both sides and wire it down so even if the water comes up, it's going to stay there. Hook your brackets onto that thing. They're going to rust, so no one's going to pay attention to them afterwards because most trappers aren't even going to notice what that is unless they go specifically there and see it. So then you've got a place because of these gullies coming off the side of the creek, you know, that. So you got a high bank and you got the low bank, and say it's on a 45 degree angle and the water's coming off the high bank and it cuts it out almost like a creek going down to it. Well, if you have something there naturally or you put something there, those coon will automatically go towards that to go down that bank. And you'll have a location that'll be red hot for years if you do something like that. And that's how guys get ahead. They know their country. They set things up in their country that do that. Around here, because I'm trapping more at home now, I can start doing more of this. When I was going out of state all the time, there was no way to do any of this stuff. Because by the time you put a log in and you're there for 10 days or 14 days and the coon starts working it, you're pulling traps and going home. So it was a waste of energy. But I went as far as putting some really good logs that got blew over in some windstorms, you know, 18 inches across. And then I put rebar on both sides of them and I used the galvanized number 9 wire and I would bend the rebars over away from where the rod was at and I would wrap that wire around that log. So even if the water comes up, the log's not going anywhere unless we just have a, you know, NOAA flood or something. And those will be there for years and years and years. And say it takes 10 years for that to totally rot out. Well, that's okay. I just cut that wire, get another log, put it back in there. Or I could use old 2x4s or 2x6s or 2x12s or whatever I find around or take with me and set these locations up. And you get a bunch of those locations set up, you're really rocking and rolling pretty quick, because now you're not looking for anything when you get out of the truck. It'll get so efficient and so fast at what you're doing, it won't be as exciting after a couple of years, because you'll start figuring out that log's worth 8, 10, 12 coon. You get 10 locations like that, you're at 100 coon, guys. 2,200, 3,300. Even if it's 5 apiece, 30 of those type locations is 150 coon that you can almost bank on. Big deal. I know the coon market's down right now, but the guys that always stay ahead of the game always are looking ahead beyond the next month. And your kids would love going out and doing something like that. We're gonna go out this beautiful spring day or fall day, and we're gonna go play around in the woods, and you know, you can make a family thing out of it. Even if you're going out of a boat, or you're going out of a canoe, or anything like that, if you've got a creek bank, and I want you to think about the efficiency of this. If you're in a canoe or you're in a boat, and you're going down a decent creek, one of the locations everybody wants to set up, because they're good locations, is where another body of water meets that water. If you follow what I'm saying there, so you got a creek or a river, and you got another body coming in there, and even if it's 8 inches deep and 12 inches wide, if you build these bridges for the coon will use those forever. It's just up to you to make them secure so they're going to be there forever. Maybe you take that on across the bank, and you can wire it to some actual trees, you know, or you're going to have to be creative, because every situation is going to be the same. You got to think out of the box a little bit. But you do that over a couple of years of spending some time doing that. When coon prices do come up, which they're going to come up, they always do, you're going to be slaying raccoons. And you're going to be doing it faster with less energy than pretty much anybody else is, because it's like you're setting the battlefield up, going into combat for your success. And if you do that with the dog proofs, especially with the Freedom brands, the way they got that bracket, if you don't have the bracket, guys, I'm not a woodworker, and this is totally theory on my part, so I want you to keep this in mind. But since I use the brackets, I've never had to do this. But when you're out and you're goofing around and you're going about your business, stuff comes in your mind. If there's something like on a battery-powered Dremel tool, if there's such a thing, or some type of tool out there that you could, or maybe it just be a drill bit that you go in 3 or 4 times and have a chisel or something that's flat to beat out a notch. So if you've got a tree or a 2x6 or something like that, and you're making these bridges, if you had a way in just a couple of minutes that you could do 3 or 4 drill holes with electric drill, and then take a piece of metal and beat it where you figured out the size of the plate on the bottom of the Freedom brand, because it wouldn't be a big slit because they're not that thick, that you could just cut that slit out. So wherever you're going to be doing, because the way that trap is made, you could set that in that wood. Now keep in mind, though, wood swells when it gets wet. If it's not that thick, if you could drill a hole all the way through the bottom, even if you had to take an extra long drill bit, so if water got in that thing, it could drain out the bottom and not freeze into an ice cube. Wherever you're building these bridges at, you take your Freedom brand, slide them down in that thing, and you could even get away with not doing the bracket. But I can tell you, the bracket's pretty easy with a cordless drill, or if it's on my drags already, or on those plates, or on a piece of metal. But, you know, think about these things as you're going out of the technical part of the season right now, and start preparing for other parts of the season. And if you want to get even more exciting on these bridges, because animals move up and down structure, a riverbank, a creek bank. Coyotes, that's a coyote location, even though people don't consider it one. I catch a lot of coyotes on side of creeks. It's a barrier. They go up against it and they go left or right. They can swim, and they do swim because I can see their tracks. Or they go to a big creek dumping into a river, and I'll see their tracks on the other side. So they definitely can and do swim. But if you build these bridges, especially on the smaller water, and they're big enough that coyotes, cats, and fox can also get on there, and mink and everything like that can use those bridges, think about the system you can have in place where you're setting these up. So you're setting the battlefield up in your favor. Because I can tell you one thing from the military, guys. You never, ever, ever, ever go into battle if you don't have the upper hand. It's stupid to do that. Now, I understand trapping is not battle or combat. That's one of the lessons we learned very quickly. There's nothing manly or heroic about going into a bad situation. So you can make these situations good. But if you built these bridges where you've got gullies coming in, or you got creeks where something can cross, and you build those things up, fishermen will walk on, won't make any difference. They'll become part of the habitat, and animals will start using it. They will change their pattern to use that, because if it's really cold, a coon's going to much rather go over that than get in the water. If a cow cannot get in the water and go across something like that, he's going to go across it. So what do you do as a trapper to take advantage of all this? You could have your dog proofs in the middle. You could use weight stakes or slide poles or whatever you wanted to do. So when you caught coons in the middle, they would go in the water off the log. So they're completely out of sight and out of mind. Or they can at least be up the bank 8 or 10 feet. But where they're not sitting right next to it, because I guarantee a big old boar coon, a coyote's not going to walk across a log if it's sitting on it or sitting next to it, because the coon's going to be very aggressive. Even though the coyote could, it's not going to take the chance to get injured to do that. So if you get the coons out of the middle with your Freedom Brands, then you can go to the ends of those, and with a good hatchet or a battery operated chainsaw or something like that. Use your mind. You're building something for the next 10 years, not for the next 2 weeks when you're doing something like this. And you can grade or make that log on the end where it's obvious how a coyote's going to go up to it. And you can pull in brambles during trapping season to give him an easy line of travel so he's not getting up 3 feet beyond your set. You can blind set a foothold at the bottom. If it's legal to set snares on that trail that the animals are going to make very apparent to you, you can hang a snare there. If it's somewhere with coon where you're allowed to use body grips on dry land, you could put a body grip right there in that trail before. So when animals come down, think about this system, guys. When an animal comes down a trail, you can pick up cats, coyotes, and fox. If you're using long snares or drags, you'll get them off of that trail or cable them off where they can get away from that thing. Then in the middle of that, you've got stuff for your coon. You can catch the coon. And on the other side, you're set up again for your coyotes, fox, and cats. And if you're using body grips, for more coon. That is a heavily concentrated system on a heavily man-trapper-made structure. And the reason I know everything crosses these things, I've been on enough of these deer places where they have swamps, especially in the south, where they have a lot of beaver, and they've got commercial hunters. And to make it easy on the commercial hunters, they build these little bridges that are only 12, 14 inches wide. You know, they're just like 2 2x6s and some pressure treated decking board on the top. Some of them are 10 foot, some of them are 4 foot. So when they take these hunters out through the swamp, they don't have city people drowning in the muck. So they can go from hard ground on these little bridges. And a lot of them will have several of them out there. Every single coyote that goes through that area uses that bridge. Every single coon. I can't say every single mink, but fox and cats, they all use those bridges. You know, and if you you can take this and get away from the water's edge some, take this same type mentality and the same type system, and if you've got any type of creek or water that's going perpendicular to the flow of the land, which we talked about a couple of weeks, or the structure of the land, you can put these little bridges in for the animals, secure them in really good, build your own locations where you know exactly where they're at, where the animals are going to be at, and where you can catch them at and get to easily. That's production style trapping right there. That's not goofing around trying to find something trapping. That's getting with it trapping right there. And you can probably take this little thing that I've done for years, because it worked so good on beaver dams, why wouldn't it work if I made it? That's kind of where it led me to that. And then the bridges on the hunting clubs kind of set that thought process in concrete, because I could see muddy coyote tracks and fox tracks and cat tracks and coon tracks and possum tracks, everything using it. So you can take that and use that on your own line and put it where you want it to be. I mean, think about how slick it is. If you've got a deep pool in a shallow creek and you set one of these bridges up and there's field on one side, and then, you know, it's not a huge field, not like Indiana or somewhere, or it's just in the woods, you can set a coon feeder on one side. All the coon are going to start using your bridge. And if you have a deep water pool and you can use the feeder to get the coon where you want them, and the trapper bridge, if that's what we're going to call this thing, to go where you want it, all of a sudden then you've got the location that you want to be hidden from competition but easy to get to at the same time, and it's an off-ball location because you're bringing the coon in there with feed, and then now you've got your location set up. You get 50 or 75 of those set up, and you want to catch 300 coon, and you got decent coon numbers, you'll be done in a week. You can catch more coon, or you can go catch something else. But if your goal is whatever it is, I mean, that's where strategy is way more important than the actual technique. Because building a trapper's bridge, I guess that's what we'll call it, a trapper's bridge for a location is a technique. A strategy is how do you implement these into a system that allows you to be highly efficient with the less expense but the most results. And once the initial work is put in putting these things in, how in the world can you beat something like that? I would really like to know. Now, if you're out in the Texas desert, you will find trails going right next to those, and some of those gullies, you might could do that if you did it from one year to the next. But in the eastern part of the country, the opportunities are everywhere. I mean, absolutely everywhere. You could do a trapper's bridge. I've only done this a few times because of the situation. I haven't taken, because of the way that I can mount the new Freedom brands on these things, it's not exactly necessary. But just for goofing around to see how far I could take this technique, you have riprap. I've used it in two different places that were very different. I've used it a couple times, but two different types of places that were very different. One was a creek going under a main road here, and it had a lot of riprap. So what I did is I took, there happened to be an old 2x12 that was about 14 feet long that someone either had washed up in the creek or someone threw out somewhere. Anyway, it was sitting there. So I took that from the riprap coming at the angle of where the brush was at down to underneath the culvert. And I piled up that riprap on both ends of that, the 2x12, so it couldn't move. Eventually a flood did get that. So, I mean, that was not exactly a permanent thing. But you had all this rough rock, and I mean, riprap's nasty to walk on anyway, and it's probably not fun for a coon to walk on. They had to walk on, they could see this thing, and they'd only have to walk on the riprap about 5 feet, then they could get on this smooth 2x12, go to where they was wanting to go. I've used the Freedom brands on that. with the brackets, and I've also snared on those out in the open. I would just take, cut a piece of brush on one side, kind of shove it down in the rocks, put my snares over the thing, and catch coons that way. And that, I guess in a way, that's a trapper's bridge. The other thing that I've done is below one of the dams we have here, the coons, you can only get so close to the dam before the federal guys get kind of upset with you. Because they see you going to the dam every day, I guess they're thinking I'm going to have a turbine hidden in the front of the boat, I guess. So you've got requirements you got to stay off of this. And the way that the dams are, you can see how raccoons and fox and stuff will go from one side of the river to the other. There's a dead road at the top. From that road edge all the way down under the water is great big riprap. I mean, great big riprap. And then where the dam breaks over, there's a ledge between that and the road. And then on the other side, you can repeat that. And we're talking big. This is like 3/4 mile long. So there was some logs that got washed up next to this dam. And I noticed coon crap on a couple of them. And I was actually trapping muskrats. I noticed coon crap on them. And so what I did is there was two or three of these logs. They were probably 18 inches around. They weren't that far from each other. So I went up there and cavemanned them things around up on that riprap. And I got them to where they were almost connected for about 30 feet. Now they're out in the middle of this riprap, about 6 feet off the water, not towards the top, not towards where that the coon trail is going over that ledge, because you can't get within 500 feet. I just gave them and all that riprap a smooth place for about 30 feet with these logs. And I put some dog proofs up there. And with the boat traffic, the coon were sitting on the other side of the log for the next 3 or 4 days when I was in that area, asleep on that riprap with that warm riprap behind them in a dog proof. Totally out of the way. And the reason I thought that that may work is I've talked to some older guys that they do a pretty unique way of gray fox trapping that I've done. And if the situation's there, it's pretty neat, because it's one of those you do feel kind of ninja about when you do it. Is they'll put in a great big showy set for a gray fox, and they'll put their set there like normal, but they put it up against a log that's 8 or 10, 12, 14 inches tall, but smooth. It where it just fell in the woods naturally, and they put their set up right against that log, and it's close to the location they wanted to be on. And then if it's rotten wood, they would take their axe, and they would chop 3 or 4 trap beds for a blind set on the very top of that log. And most of the gray fox would get caught on the log and not at the set, because they had height to look down on what's going on. They could do what they always do, which is they somehow know where you want them to go, and they go the opposite direction. But on that log, they would get on top of it, and they would use that as a way to try to get at the set from the back, where if something's in the hole, it's not going to be, they're not going to be at the front door, if you kind of get what I'm saying. And these old timers would catch these gray fox that way. And I've done that. And I was looking at this riprap on this dam, and I'm thinking, well, if I do that to those logs, even though it's out of askew of anything that's going on, but it gives them about 30 feet of easy walking. And while I was there, I think there was only one day that I didn't catch raccoons, but I did have a couple doubles off of that. Super simple. Eventually, the guys that did the dam took the logs away. But the same principle could work anywhere. And that's what made that technique so, so cool. We're not going to get to everything today, but I do want to end on something, and I wish I had my glasses. So I may stumble around a little bit. Guys, if you want to get in the ADC business, or you want to write something in a local newspaper, or you want to be on a blog for your trapping, or whatever it is, because if a trapper is going to have to come to terms, you're selling your service, period. If you're a trapper and you want to trap, you're selling your service to trapping, even if you don't charge money. And to do that, you've got to understand advertising and marketing to sell, so it comes across pretty smooth. if you follow what I'm saying. So doing it is very good. Now, if you're doing a supply business or you're doing a description and you're doing different things like that, and a trapper's got all these different options, comes across your website or whatever you've written somewhere, and you look just like every other trapping catalog and website out there, and you say the same thing. Because, I mean, you can go to websites where one website copy and paste off another website that copy and paste off another website that copy and paste off another website, and they wonder why no one's excited about what they're selling. Because the same person's seen it over and over again. They don't know where it originated from. They really don't care where it originated from. But every time you copycat something and have generic stuff talking about it, it's not going to wind somebody up. Now, what I'm getting her to read you is one of the most creative things. And I wish I had my phone with me. I would say who sent me this. This is from Craigslist. This is marketing PhD style right now. I want you to think. You can't see the picture because we're talking. A 1978 blue, faded blue, dually four-wheel drive Blazer with a big block. That is not where our culture is going as far as vehicles. This guy wanted to sell this 1978 454 big block, four-wheel drive, dually Suburban. So he did his text. Now, what do most people on Craigslist do? Just like trappers do. Got a 1978 Suburban Blue, good shape, took care of it. Grandma's the only one that drove it. Seats need a little work. Tires are in good shape. So many miles, yada, yada, yada. Call me if you're interested. Whoopee! I mean, as far as marketing go, I mean, that's about as boring can get. This guy in 2015 had a car that he needed to sell that I know from having a Blazer with a 454 in it. It got 4.5 miles per gallon, and that's not as big, and it wasn't a dually. So this thing's probably getting at the best 4 miles per gallon on level road. It was a huge vehicle in 1978. So he could have did what everybody else does and probably wouldn't have sold this. And luckily I could find this online because he sold this Blazer in 2 days. Something that most people could care less about. But when I read you through this, not only is this entertaining, guys, this is entertaining. This guy knew who his market was. Who would want a faded blue with primer patches on it, dually four-wheel drive with a big block? He thought about who his market was. He thought about what would turn on his market. He thought about what would get his market's attention. And he sold something that's very, very grossly unpractical for anything in today's world, really, besides just a man thing. So I want to read this to you. If you want to know how to sell stuff, if you got a trap and supply business, or even if you're trying to do predator control work or bat work or mole work, or you're wanting to sell used traps, or you're wanting to get permission on property and you're going to send out letters or put an ad in the newspaper or put some on the internet, I want you to think about this, and I would bookmark this radio show. So before you go to do anything, go back and listen to this. Okay, remember, it's not even a pretty looking Suburban. It's rough. Okay, now I'm going to read this to you. This is marketing 101. Well, no, this ain't marketing 101. This is marketing PhD. Stop. Close your eyes. Take a deep breath. Feast your eyes on the most wicked piece of American badass you've ever seen in your life. I'll tell you right now that if you are at Starbucks drinking if you're at Starbucks being a drinking environmentalist, if your other car is a Prius or a solar-powered liberal mobile, if you think you are safer if no one owned a handgun, or if you have used objective admiralty at all today, then you need to close this window and look for another vehicle. And, in quotation marks, grow a pair. If you're a beer-drinking, red-blooded American that has a beer, chews tobacco, dreams of wrestling an Alaskan grizzly bear, and wants the most badass truck on the road, then keep reading. This truck is like the deadliest catch without the crabs. Now that I have your attention, you need to ask yourself one question. Are you ready for a truck with this much testosterone? Well, are you? Big question mark. Just to let you know, the sheer presence of this Suburban is enough to make Chuck Norris pee his pants. Take a look at these pictures. Yes, it's staring back at you. Now go change your underwear and continue reading. What my friend is more reliable than an American 454 big block nuclear power plant with a carburetor the size of Roseanne Arnold's big butt. Nothing can be more reliable because it is backed by the great Turbo 400. What is cooler than having a transmission with a designation of turbo in front of it? Fuel mileage, you ask. If you're concerned about fuel mileage, check your phone because your boyfriend is on the other end of the line. Air conditioning, yeah, front and rear. Who needs it? Roll down four windows, take a breath. You need some fresh air anyway. Let the wind blow through your hair. No, excuse me. Let the wind blow through your beard. There's nothing this Suburban cannot do. It is a dually 14-bolt corporate axle. Yes, sir. It's bulletproof Dana 60, you ask yourself. When was the last time you had a vehicle could do all the following? Tow a John Deere 827OR, bass boat, duck boat, trailer full of walrus meat. All at the same time. Burbzilla can do it. I guess that's the name of his Suburban. It will do it while hauling five of your beer drinking buddies, all of your gear, and a couple of dogs in the back. When you get back, open the doors, fire up the gas powered pressure washer, and let her rip. The juggernaut has drain holes in it so the blood of your buffalo can drain out after you've killed it. That's right, there's no frills, no BS interior. The custom made front end, rear seat covers are weatherproof, the carpet has been removed. What else is this behemoth capable of? Unless you're completely blind and slightly retarded, you're probably noticing it's a four-wheel drive vehicle. I've been told from previous owners that it has literally traveled to hell and back. Lucifer himself was crying like a pansy. Pull up a chair and read the closing paragraph. These wheels are slightly used. When I say slightly, I warn you a bit of caution, for what you're about to read is as serious as it gets. The tire and wheel package was removed from a real military Humvee. The 36-inch tires wrapped around DOT legal bead-locked wheels were carrying American soldiers through enemy territory when a grenade immobilized the Humvee. The soldiers and the Humvee were saved with an airstrike from the good old Uncle Sam. These tires under the Suburban have rolled American soldiers through enemy territory and saved their life. Gentlemen, if I had been born with tear ducts, I'd probably be crying right now. This is a true story. Now, if you can tell me what is more American than a piece of grit of iron from American history, you, sir, are a man among men. I will give you a word of caution to whomever may purchase a steel juggernaut from the following. This will happen. Your beard will grow longer. You will only eat meat. You will get a T-Rex for a pet. You may start to think you are a lumberjack. You will wipe your butt with sandpaper, brush your teeth with a wire brush. Your wife will be hotter. You will get more women on the side. Your wife will keep your fridge fully stocked of beer. You will have sex with your wife in the garage on top of the Suburban. You will make more money. You will hunt and kill every animal known to man. George Bush will be your neighbor. You will fill your garbage with Snap-on, your garage with Snap-on tools, and you'll learn to weld. You will listen to nothing but Waylon Jennings, which I thought Chip would like that because he's trying to get me to play that on the radio. You will listen to nothing but Waylon Jennings. You'll get a second freezer to keep your game meat and fish. You'll deep Copenhagen. You'll keep a 45 on your sides at all time. People will want to be you. If you could handle this, American chariot of the free world, please respond. If not, your yoga instructor is calling. Please note, I will not sell to any LSU fans. Go Rebels. Guys, He sold something off of that description right there. Now, if you're in the supply business, or the lure business, or the predator control business, or any other type of business, every time you go to write print ads, I want you to go back and listen to that. This man knew his market. He knew what would his market would respond to. He didn't go to the willy-washy, pansy, limp-wristed way of, I don't want to make anybody mad or upset, and I got to make it conform to everybody so no one really gives a crap style of advertising. He went straight to his market. He hit the things that would get American male redneck that wants a bad-to-the-bone truck's attention. And he sold it. $4,200 for a vehicle that you can't even park in a Walmart parking lot because it's so big and probably doesn't get 5 miles per gallon going downhill. That is what advertising is. And no matter what you do in trapping, no matter what you want to believe you're doing in trapping, just to get trapping permission, sometimes you've got to understand your market, understand what interests them, find a way in words to turn them on, get them involved, get them interested, and then close the deal. And that's what this gentleman did, talking about a burnout Suburban. Kudos to him. Now, my question is, the next time that you're going to be selling, what you do every single day, I don't care what you do, even if you're trying to convince your wife to get or not to get an above ground pool in the backyard or a new welder, you're selling, guys. The next time that happens, I want you to think about the ugly four-wheel drive dually Suburban that's got a 454 nuclear power plant under the hood. Well, I'll see y'all guys next week. Take 30 minutes this week, guys. Go out on your trapping grounds and see where you can put those trapping bridges in. That right there, that little information right there on that, thinking about a stage system to catch multiple animals at a man-made location where it's easy for you to get to and all the animals are going to be, that's just like the Suburban. It'll go through hell and back and get you all the critters you want to get. So go out and find them. Don't watch as much TV this week. Start putting in those bridges. And then when the next season comes and you got fur piled up above your ears, you'll just grin because you'll know everybody else is running around doing it the other way. We all have a good week, guys, and I'll see y'all next week.